Welcome to Spotlight. Russia says it has adopted a new foreign policy in order to counter existential threats to its security and development from unfriendly states. President Putin says the change in Moscow's key foreign policy concept is due to significant changes in world affairs. The top priority for Russia in its new approach is set to be the elimination of U.S. Southwestern dominance in global politics. The concept also stresses the importance of the deepening of Moscow's ties with friendly international centers of power and development located in the Eurasian continent. What impact could this new Russian doctrine have on world affairs at a time that there are growing efforts by countries from across the world to distance themselves from Western dominance? Joining us on Spotlight, we have activist and commentator Don DeBar, joining us from Austin, New York. And also we have researcher at Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies from Uppsala, Sweden, Mr. Greg Simons.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, General, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. DeBar. Russia says it has adopted a new foreign policy doctrine, prioritizing the elimination of what it calls Western dominance in global politics. Tell us more about what kind of an approach Moscow should have to challenge that dominance.
Well, what they've announced is, in essence, a five-point plan. That's how it's being advertised in Russian media. Identifying the major threats to international peace, which is the United States and the EU and the Western bloc in general. Statement of relations with the West. They don't consider the West an enemy, and they hope to reset relations in a way that's at least constructive and allows a modus vivendi. That they recognize a system should exist and help to bring into existence a system of equality among all nations, large, small, regardless of where they're located. Identifying key allies, particularly China and India, in constructing this, essentially new world, and looking to develop a global and regional cooperation, and promising to people in Africa, Latin America, and Asia that they would stand with them as they seek to chart their own course. So I think it's essentially a look at the world that exists as it is, identifying some of the key problems that exist in international relations, which are problems that confront all of humanity, really, looking at, assessing what they have to work with, looking around the region and around the world, and attempting to construct something positive that will help to solve the problems that we all face.
Greg Simons, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said that the country faces existential threats to its security and development from quote-unquote unfriendly states. Can you elaborate on those key points for us?
Well, when he's talking about unfriendly states, of course, he's referring to the US-led Western-centric order. So, I mean, this includes, of course, those institutions such as the EU and NATO. So North America, the European Union, you've got South Korea, Japan, Australia, New Zealand. So these are the ones, the so-called international order, as they call themselves, or the rules-based order, that have been working at containing Russia for some time within the framework of this new Cold War. And, of course, this has been something which is understood from Russia through the foreign policy doctrines for at least a decade. So this process, which he's talking about, is about the complete detachment from this Western-centric order, which was initiated by the sanctions, which were occurring since at least 2014 and intensified in the last 2 years.
Sure. Don DeBar, the new foreign policy, it outlines how Russia could take, quote, symmetrical and asymmetric measures in response to unfriendly actions against it. Is one way of translating that NATO's provocations and its eastward expansion and then the ensuing Ukraine war that started last year? All right, I believe we've lost that connection with Mr. DeBar. Mr. DeBar, apologies. We're experiencing some technical difficulties with your sound. While my colleagues figure that out, let's address that question to Mr. Simons. Talk to us about the same issue that we just mentioned with Mr. DeBar about the asymmetric measures, symmetrical and asymmetric measures in response to unfriendly actions against Russia. One way that we could translate that is what took place with regards to the Ukraine war. That was NATO's expansion eastward, NATO's provocations, Russia's warnings, and then the ensuing events that took place in Ukraine.
It's including this, but it's much more, because we have these little color revolutions, so-called, which have been occurring in not only at this post-Soviet space, but they've been attempted inside Russia. So these are part of those asymmetric measures, that political destabilization of Russia. And we can also look at the RAND report from 2019, which talked about destabilizing Belarus and destabilizing Central Asia, Syria, and also Ukraine and the South Caucasus as a means of overextending Russia. So Russia knows well these different tactics, political subversion, these kind of hybrid warfare measures, information warfare, political warfare. These are the kinds of things which have been happening for a couple of decades now. And so, I mean, they've been intensifying as the power and the influence of the US unipolar order recedes. So, I mean, this is also a concern for Russia.
Sure. We're back with Mr. Don DeBar. I hope we've figured out what was going wrong. Mr. DeBar, pick up where you left off with regards to the events that have taken place in Ukraine.
Yeah, to amplify what we just heard also. You know, you look back to history, to the closing years of the Eisenhower administration and the first year of the Kennedy administration, for a couple of years, there was a plan to install Jupiter missiles in Turkey, which at the time gave the United States an advantage in terms of delivering nuclear weapons to the Soviet Union in the event of a war. This is before the age of reliable ICBMs, and so by putting these missiles close to the Soviet Union, they became an immediate threat. At the time that it was finally installed in the first year of the Kennedy administration, Senator Mike Mansfield told President Kennedy, look, this is a mistake. You may end up provoking the Soviet Union into putting these things into Cuba or somewhere else. And lo and behold, a year later, they had done exactly that. All of the things that have been done with the U.S. and NATO encroaching on the four corners, really, of Russia. You've got from the Baltics to the Korean Peninsula, an encirclement of Russia and China. The world has been developing in a way, in no small part thanks to the actions of the United States, to where you now have an alliance of interest of Russia, China, India, Iran, and others, with a number of countries in the Western Hemisphere, from Mexico to Venezuela to Nicaragua, Cuba, etc. And so, you know, what Russia was enunciating, not really even behind the lines here, is the fact that these things that you've installed on our borders, we can easily do that to you too, at least functionally. You know, installing some really heavy-duty weapons in Cuba, for example, the fact that it's 90 miles away and not on the border is completely insignificant in terms of the operation of these things militarily. And you have countries across the Western Hemisphere that have been dominated some since the early part of the 19th century by the United States, that have already been trading with China as an alternative. If you look, for example, to Bolivia as a trading partner with China, as opposed to the United States, it does three or four times as much trade with China. These are all places that are certainly looking to develop those relations further, and being offered a military option, a protection from the United States, is going to be appealing as hell, and that's going to be more and more true as time passes. So Russia is not without the possibility of doing a quid pro quo or a tit for tat with the U.S. as the U.S. continues to pressure it.
Greg Simons, this document presented by the Russian foreign minister also identifies China and India as Russia's key partners. What could this partnership mean in terms of instigating a new global order opposed to a Western-driven front?
Well, in terms of human resources, financial resources, and military resources, the West cannot hope to even equal it. So if you get those three countries functioning together and cooperating, I mean, this is worse than the US nightmares which Kissinger tried to prevent by breaking the People's Republic of China from the Soviet Union. It's much more problematic for the West, because the West now, unlike in the 1960s, is in decline. And it cannot manage, in terms of capacity and capability, what it used to be able to do. So, with India included, I mean, this makes it hugely problematic to start containing both China and Russia, something which has been noted by your previous speaker. I mean, it's slipping through their fingers rapidly and absolutely in no small measure owing to their own ham-fisted and arrogant way of pursuing foreign policy, their foreign policy interests, at the expense of the interests of other countries.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Don DeBar, it's not just the countries that were mentioned being China and India. There's also Iran, of course, plus Russia turning its attention to South American and African countries, which are all keen on enhancing their relationships with Moscow. How can these closer economic and security ties challenge U.S. political and military alliances?
Well, first of all, at the foundation of it is a new economic paradigm. The model that's prevailed, basically, the global economic model that's prevailed almost since the 16th century, that has been one of European and then North American colonialism, and in essence a drawing of wealth, labor, raw material from the various four corners of the world back to the colonial powers, and Britain, France, Spain, et cetera, and then ultimately the United States, particularly in the post-World War II era. That has allowed the hyper-development of the Western countries, of the golden billion in Europe and of the North America, north of Rio Grande anyway, and that has also led to the immiseration of people around the world. And it's also been the source of global instability, wars, famine, all kinds of refugee and migration problems, and others, and starvation. For example, 9 million people starve to death every year. There's a consequence of that same foreign policy. They're talking about, in essence, and China and others have been demonstrating, in fact, for some time now, an alternate model. The Chinese call it win-win. In essence, the theory being that mutual development and mutual benefit of trade means that each of the trading partners that one deals with becomes more affluent and more, in essence, a better partner to do business with. That model is the alternative that's been offered in Latin America and Asia and Africa now for some years. We're seeing the development of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, of Mercosur, and a variety of these things across the areas I described, the so-called Global South. Whatever else rises will rest on that foundation, and that has been sort of coming into being for a good period of time now. We've seen China looking at developing transportation infrastructure in Africa and Latin America, talking particularly in terms of a canal in Nicaragua, transcontinental railroad in South America and Africa, all kinds of things along the Belt and Road Project. And so these are things that, a new global order will rest upon, and the military and strategic interests of the world will shift to defend this thing that will be the lifeblood of, if you're talking about just Russia, China, and India, more than half the human population. And then add Africa's billion people to that, and the 700 or 800 million people in Latin America and the Caribbean, you're talking more about three quarters of the human population.
Greg Simons, while Western countries led by the U.S. have been pressuring and provoking Moscow, and with it Beijing, at increasing levels, it seems now that the two are moving closer together at a rapid pace. Analysts believe that the U.S. itself has invigorated this alliance, and the closer ties between Russia and China is a response to Washington's antagonizing behavior and is in competition with the U.S. and its own alliances. Do you see it in that light as well?
Absolutely. I mean, U.S. geostrategy, it gets imagined in these different brands. So you have this new Cold War. And in the new Cold War, initially you had Russia, because Russia was proving a problem for U.S. Total dominance in Europe. And then shortly after that, you had Obama and his Asia pivot. So China got added to that. So if we look at U.S. geostrategy, they have three problematic powers which they're trying to control and contain. And they're doing this not consecutively, but together, simultaneously. And so you have the issue of Russia in Europe, China, Asia Pacific, and Iran in the Middle East. So what you have here, the natural reaction to that, because everyone knows the US is weakening. I mean, they fled from Afghanistan in a very, demonstrative manner about this, signaling it to the world. So the thing is, this goes against Brzezinski's geostrategic imperative of preventing an alliance of different powers. This is, according to realist theory, the nightmare of the United States. And absolutely, they are causing this, because the natural geostrategic counter to that is to join together your resources and your capabilities and capacities and just overrun the U.S. capacity. I mean, as a declining power, they cannot hope to match.
Sure. Don DeBar, the Russian foreign minister, said the West is trying to weaken Russia in every possible way through a new type of hybrid war. Why does the West, being the U.S. and its allies, want a weakened Russia?
Well, as someone who's born and bred and currently residing in the United States, I don't see all of this as being in my interest. And the bulk of the people that live in the United States, as well as the bulk of the people that live in Europe, if they take an honest look at this, once given the opportunity to do that, of course, recognize that it's not in our interest to do this at all. The cooperation and trade and all the positive things that can come from, you know, a peaceful, cooperative world benefit everyone. The problem is that the government structures, the power in the United States and Europe, rests in the hands of a very small group of people who see global domination, personal global domination, as their right, or certainly it's their goal. And they have captured, or they helped create and have maintained control of the power levers in the United States, the military and intelligence agencies in particular, and heavy and light industry and finance. And they use that as a weapon against the rest of the world to extend and maintain their control elsewhere. Russia is taking a very realistic look at the United States, saying, on the one hand, these policies that you and the EU and Japan also, currently are throwing at us, they are dangerous to us and they will be countered, but we do not give up on the opportunity and the effort to try to cooperation in a bunch of areas of mutual beneficial interest. And we think that that is a route for humanity. What I think needs to happen is, in the United States and Europe in particular, the people have to stand up and say, we want to be friends. Why can't we be friends? We don't want to spend $1 trillion a year on a military to fight nobody that's after my things, that look seeking to harm me, just to further the interests of a few bunch of people who, in fact, also have their hand in my pocket. I think we have to get there somehow. I don't know how we do it, but I think it's the most urgent task facing humanity, really, is for the people in the belly of the beast here in the U.S., Europe, and Japan to get control of the government on behalf of the people that live here and make it start responding to our needs instead of the needs of a very small group of psychotic people, really.
Mr. Simons, the U.S. and co. have imposed several rounds of sanctions on Russia over the war in Ukraine, but Russia says that its economy has remained resilient and the sanctions have actually hurt Western countries. Now, Russia definitely has a point here as we look at the economic twists and turns in European countries. It's definitely worth mentioning, isn't it?
When you wage economic warfare, because these are what sanctions are, a form of economic warfare, Iran knows it, Cuba knows it, Venezuela knows it, there is no one-way effect. There is always an effect upon the one who's waging it. I mean, if we go back, if we look at Russia, but if we look at historical precedents, when Cuba was freed from its American-backed dictator, they nationalized sugar and tobacco. The United States imposed sanctions and the United Kingdom on Cuba. And almost immediately, the price of sugar and tobacco started increasing in price. So, I mean, that's against Cuba. And this is decades ago. And Cuba is not the same as what Russia is today. And so you're going to have massive problems because you're disrupting all of the economic flows, these so-called forms of globalism, which were intended to enrich the West. It's not intended to enrich Russia or other non-Western countries. It's intended to enrich those so-called Western elites. So, yes, I mean, it's a stupid policy. It's short-sighted, and like so many other occasions in history, that there is always at least some form of negative action, and living in Europe, you can feel it with the cost of living and all of these other things, because Europe is not independent of the United States. They're acting as its stooges and paying the And the ordinary person is paying the price. So this is where I agree with the previous other speaker, that there needs to be a time when people say enough is enough. It's time to pursue sell our own interests and not this very narrow set of elite interests.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Activist and commentator Don DeBar joining us from Ossining, New York, and researcher at Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies, Mr. Greg Simons, speaking to us from Uppsala, Sweden. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll try to have a look at the commentary of Chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode. Dear listeners, now let's listen to these verses, verse 200, 201, and 202.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
كذلك سلكناه في قلوب المجرمين.
Thus have we inserted disbelief into the hearts of the criminals.
لا يؤمنون به حتى يروا العذاب الأليم.
They will not believe in it until they see the painful punishment.
فَيَأْتِيَهُمْ بَغْتَةً وَهُمْ لَا يَشْعُرُونَ.
And it will come to them suddenly, while they perceive it not.
كَذَلِكَ سَلَكْنَاهُ فِي قُلُوبِ الْمُجْرِمِينَ. Thus, we caused it passing into the hearts of the sinners. لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ بِهِ حَتَّى يَرَوُ الْعَذَابَ الْأَلِيمِ. They will not believe in it until they see the painful punishment. فَيَأْتِيَهُمْ بَغْتَةً وَهُمْ لَا يَشْعُرُونَ. And it shall come upon them all of a sudden while they are not aware. In these couple of verses, dear listeners, we understand that the Almighty Allah always completes the argument for the mankind. And it is even true with the pagans. So Allah exposes it to them and causes it to pass into their hearts. But if there is not any receptivity, even the Quran is not effective. So, in this verse, therefore, he says, كَذَلِكَ سَلَكْنَاهُ فِي قُلُوبِ الْمُجْرِمِينَ. Thus, we caused it passing into the hearts of the sinners. Allah sent the Quran down with clear statements in the language of their own people, and unto a man from among them who was well acquainted with their customs, and its content had been confirmed by the former divine books. Now, what else did they need? That's why, as you might remember, in the previous verses we read, أَوَلَمْ يَكُنْ لَهُمْ آيَةٌ. Is it not a sign to them? أَن يَعْلَمَهُ عُلَمَاءُ بَنِي إِسْرَائِيلَ. Even this fact alone, the fact that the children, learned children of Israel, knew about it, must suffice them to believe in the contents and the call of the Holy Quran. But they do not believe. But yet, Almighty Allah always completes the arguments, even with the pagans. كَذَلِكَ سَلَكْنَاهُ فِي قُلُوبِ الْمُجْرِمِينَ. Thus, we caused it passing into the hearts of the sinners.
مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qum.
So, in short, كَذَلِكَ سَلَكْنَاهُ فِي قُلُوبِ الْمُجْرِمِينَ means Allah sent the Quran with all the conditions which made the acceptance of it easy for the Jews in the hearts of those sinful people. But those diseased hearts denied accepting it. They negated it. It is like the sound nutritious food that a sick stomach does not receive. It is because of that stomach, because of the receptivity, and that's why it rejects it. So the verse says, لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ بِهِ حَتَّى يَرَوُ الْعَذَابَ الْأَلِيمِ. But they will not believe in it until they see the painful punishment. The Arabic phrase salaknahu in the beginning of the first verse is derived from the word suluk, which means passing a way, coming from one side and going out from another side. Yet, they do not believe in it until the divine punishment suddenly overtakes them while they do not perceive. Yet, it was passed into their hearts, but they did not want to listen, but they did not want to believe. So the verse says, لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ بِهِ حَتَّى يَرَوُ الْعَذَابَ الْأَلِيمِ. They will not believe in it until they see the painful punishment. فَيَأْتِيَهُمْ بَغْتَةً. The Holy Quran continues, and it shall come upon them all of a sudden. No doubt, the purpose of this divine punishment, which suddenly seizes them, is the worldly chastisement and the destructive affliction, which is called istisal, the divine punishment for the unchangeable sinners. فَيَأْتِيَهُمْ بَغْتَةً. It comes upon them all of a sudden. And the ugly and beautiful rites and traditions, and in other words, racial bigotries work as a curtain of ignorance which covers the man's thoughts, apprehension, and wisdom, and bars that correct judgment works. So this is how they did not believe. لا يؤمنون به. It was because of this ignorance. It was because of this racial bigotry. This state of bigotry has a harsher form among some tribes. For example, a group of Arabs were known as zealous people, and they are referred to in these verses even. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
With reporters.
A British public school in London has sparked controversy amid furious parent complaints that their children are being prevented from performing obligatory Islamic prayers during school hours. Michaela Community School in Wembley have been accused of blatant Islamophobia after students allegedly informed parents of several incidents which saw teachers interrupting praying pupils in an apparent attempt to ban Muslim worship. News first broke of the scandal after a petition was launched demanding that the school provide a prayer space for students. The petition lists examples of what allegedly took place.
On Thursday, the 23rd of March, students at Michaela were performing their obligatory prayers at the schoolyard. The pupils were praying on their prayer mats, and the teacher approaches the students and tells them to stop praying. She then says, "You need to leave your Islamic cultures alone. This is the West." She then tells them that they're not allowed a prayer mat at this school, and she says if she sees this again, she will give them a detention. One of the students praying was then excluded.
The story is concerning enough on its own, but what makes matters worse is that it's far from the only example of a UK school apparently showing signs that it may have a problem with its religious Muslim students. Over the past 24 months, multiple other examples have popped up across the country with schools facing similar accusations.
In December 2021, Manchester's Oldham Academy School apologised after students felt forced to pray outside in the cold. In January 2022, Park High School in Stanmore went viral over footage allegedly showing a teacher attempting to halt Juma prayers. While this year has also seen two Birmingham-based schools embroiled in a row over LGBT propaganda lessons, seemingly targeting Muslim students in an attempt to change their understanding of Islam's position on same-gender relationships.
Don't remain silent, don't suffer in silence. So in specific cases like these, school kids need to record these incidents and write down witness statements ASAP and then get parents and police involved, because when the shoe is on the other foot and a Muslim child is accused of extremism, police are called in against you. Equality cuts both ways. And the bigger picture, it needs to involve a sustained effort by the Muslim community to abnormalize Islamophobia in media and politics. So irrelevant politicians and journalists who have nothing useful to say to society stop benefiting from dividing us.
Michaela Community School has so far not responded to the story. But with so many similar incidents of alleged Islamophobia occurring in UK schools, the toxic atmosphere is likely part of a much bigger problem. Robert Carter, London.
A new report by the UNHCR has revealed that women's businesses in Afghanistan are severely affected by the Taliban's increasing restrictions. The report shows a sharp decline of women's participation in the labor market from 28% to 7%, and the consequent impact on the Afghan economy, that is witnessing a 30 to 35% drop in GDP in the past 2 years.
We Afghan women can help Afghanistan economy and people's livelihood grow. Afghanistan is a rich country, especially when it comes to agricultural minerals and handicraft. Afghan women can play a vital role in developing these sectors and contributing to national incomes. However, they need more opportunities and support to lead their business and pursue their passions. This means they need work license, freedom of movement, and access to local and global market.
Here in the women's market in Kabul, we spoke with some business women who told us their stories of hardship and resilience amid the Taliban's limitations. They say they're losing customers and opportunities which are meant to develop their businesses. Some of them have experienced a significant drop in their income, while others fear they may have to shut down their businesses soon.
Unfortunately, the Taliban's restrictions on women have wiped out educational and business opportunities. Women can't work in such a limited environment. Here in the women's market, we are receiving fewer customers, contractors, and funds than ever before. My fellow entrepreneurs are desperate, with some aiming to close their shops and end activities.
Many NGOs have stopped working with business women after the Taliban banned NGOs' female workers. These NGOs used to help us with getting work permits, finding contractors, and supplying some essentials. But all these supports are gone. As a result, we are operating at a loss since we have to pay for farmers' wages and production costs without any income.
Emphasizing the need for women's economic empowerment, UNHCR has called on the Taliban to respect and safeguard the rights to work and education for women. The agency has also appealed to the international community to sustain its support for humanitarian and development initiatives that benefit women and girls in Afghanistan. The plight of Afghan business women is just one example of how Afghan women are impacted by the Taliban restrictions. Now it's a matter of time that whether the de facto authorities will change their policies against women. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The strike group of the USS Nimitz aircraft carrier conducted military exercises off the Korean Peninsula this week. This follows 11 days of the largest land-based drills involving South Korea and the U.S. in almost 5 years. The U.S. has increased joint drills with South Korea in the past year, particularly those involving nuclear-capable weapons, so-called strategic assets.
The United States has deployable strategic assets at the ready on every day. And we can continue to deploy those assets, and we will. Again, we really want to underpin the international security and the global commons so we can all prosper. And I think that's our message.
North Korea protested the drills test-firing ballistic and cruise missiles as Pyongyang views such exercises as a rehearsal for invasion. The Nimitz drills were followed up with a massive joint U.S.-South Korea amphibious landing exercise Wednesday. Activists argue such drills carry risks.
The more South Korea-U.S. military exercises are conducted, the larger the scale, the stronger the North is protesting and testing more missiles. If the South Korea-U.S. military exercises expand, the confrontation will intensify, and I think increase this vicious cycle of confrontation.
For President Yoon Suk-yeol, the drills show how he's succeeded in strengthening the U.S.-South Korea alliance. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol earlier this month re-emphasized his hardline position with North Korea, saying that Pyongyang would pay a price for its recent missile launches, what he calls provocations. President Yoon also said North Korea would not receive a penny in aid from the South as long as it continued its nuclear weapons development. The confrontation on the Korean Peninsula may heat up further with even larger exercises planned to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the U.S.-South Korea alliance in June. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A massive march has been held along the fence separating the Gaza Strip from the occupied territories to commemorate the 47th anniversary of the Land Day. People from all walks of life took to the streets of the besieged Gaza Strip to stress their right to return to their land.
We are here today to commemorate the Land Day to stress on our Palestinian identity and our entitlement to the land. We say to the Israeli occupation, you have no place in Palestine. Leave it so the world can eventually enjoy peace and freedom.
Land Day marks the events of March the 30th, 1976, where six Palestinians were killed by Israeli forces during peaceful protests against the Tel Aviv regime's decision to seize tracts of Palestinian-owned lands. Palestinians call on the international community and the Arab countries to support the Palestinian people in their quest for liberation.
We are addressing all the international community, the Arabs, the Muslims in the world, to stand up, to stand up with us. To support also our resistance to return to my home. We are refugees. We are going to return sooner or later.
The National and Islamic Action factions emphasized the unity of the Palestinian people. They also reaffirmed the Palestinians' right to resist, stressing that resistance is the sole way to restore the stolen Palestinian land.
Today we assert on the Palestinians' adherence to their lands and to the Al-Quds, the eternal capital of Palestine, and we affirm on the resistance as the most appropriate choice to free Palestine.
The Thursday peaceful demonstration turned violent when the Israeli forces shot and injured a Palestinian with live ammunition. Two others were injured when they were hit by tear gas canisters used by the regime's troops to disperse the protesters. This reminds us of what happened in the Great March of Return rallies, which began in 2018 and lasted for 86 weeks. During the protests, more than 300 Palestinians were killed by the Israeli troops, and thousands more sustained injuries, including so serious wounds that led to the loss of limbs.
I was wounded with Israeli live ammunition in the Great March of Return, and today, despite my injury in my leg that might get amputated, I am here today to commemorate the Land Day, stress on our steadfastness despite the Israeli atrocities.
The Israeli regime seizes the Palestinian own land and demolishes Palestinians' homes in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds in order to construct new illegal settlements.
These annual demonstrations serve as an act of collective resistance to the Israeli occupation, as Palestinian demonstrators voice their anger at the regime's crimes and land grab policies and reiterate their entitlement and right of return to their own land, Al-Asif, Gaza.
Russia and Iran are in the final stage of finalizing a draft agreement on comprehensive partnership between the countries.
I am very grateful that the draft of comprehensive agreement on strategic partnership between our countries has been reviewed and finalized in Russia. We are now reviewing it again as well. I very much hope that within the next month, the legal departments of the foreign ministries of our two countries will finalize this draft.
The document is of strategic importance of solid, balanced new realities of bilateral cooperation between Moscow and Tehran. The treaty outlines the main guidelines for further building of the entire complex of Russian-Iranian relations for the coming decades. Among them is that Iran and Russia both agree that the JCPOA has no alternatives and needs to be implemented as soon as possible.
We talked about the situation around the JCPOA on the Iranian nuclear program. We have a common understanding that there is no alternative to this international agreement, which was written down in the unanimously adopted UN Security Council Resolution 2231. We are in favor of the early resumption of the full implementation of this resolution and oppose actions that prevent this.
Lavrov said that the U.S. needs to lift sanctions against Iran and return to its obligations under JCPOA. The minister added that the West also seeks to neutralize China along with Russia.
Therefore, Russia, Iran, China, and many other countries will categorically oppose attempts to establish Western hegemony forever and ever, as Washington and its henchmen are trying to do.
Lavrov noted that Russia respects Iran's interests in a peaceful settlement of the Ukrainian conflict. Amir Abdullahian, for his part, pointed out that Western supplies of various weapons to Kyiv complicate the Ukraine conflict, which he said should only be settled via political means. Meanwhile, Russian-Iranian cooperation in the military technical sphere is carried out in accordance with Russia's international obligations. The parties have found an approach in all areas when it is possible to concentrate on coinciding interests and systematically build up economic cooperation as well.
Russia has become the largest investor in Iran over the past fiscal year. Russia accounted for 2/3 of the total foreign direct investments in the Islamic Republic. The volume of Moscow's investments in Iran has reached $2.76 billion. Marina Kartonova, Moscow.
The margins were slim, the result momentous. Hamza Yousaf, a Muslim of Pakistani and Kenyan descent, becoming leader of the Scottish National Party after a bruising leadership campaign.
It is hard for me to find the words to describe just how honoured I am to be entrusted by our membership of the SNP to be the party's next leader and to be on the cusp of being our country's next First Minister.
The party he leads has a slim majority in the Scottish Parliament and has been working in coalition with the Progressive Green Party, for whom Yousaf, who has pledged continuity with his liberal predecessor Nicola Sturgeon's era, is perhaps the right successor, compared to Economy Minister Kate Forbes, whose campaign got off to a rocky start over her socially conservative views.
I think there'd be a sigh of relief because I think if Kate Forbes, who got a far higher vote than was expected, but if Kate Forbes had won, then the Greens had said they were not going to serve under her. So there's a sigh of relief that the coalition will continue.
The new First Minister faces major challenges, though. Record-high National Health Service waiting times under him as Health Minister. Nicola Sturgeon's education promises yet to be fulfilled. And the UK government's blocking of a cross-party act of the Scottish Parliament on gender self-ID, which exposed deep divisions within the SNP, plus the issue of Scottish independence.
As First Minister, Hamza Yousaf has promised to lead for all in a country of 5.5 million. Yet despite the country being stuck around 50-50 on the question of independence from the UK and of Westminster, he has pledged to make it happen.
The last unsuccessful independence referendum was held in 2014, and the most recent attempt at holding a second one without the consent of Westminster was struck down by the UK's Supreme Court.
A lot of independent supporters, not just SNP members, feel frustrated. There have been constant promises, yes, there'll be a referendum, constant promises of a big campaign which never materialised. People are becoming frustrated, and I think Hamza, as First Minister, is going to have to address that.
Outgoing First Minister Nicola Sturgeon tendered her resignation to the UK King on Tuesday. It remains to be seen if her successor will make her the last one. Saeed Bourza, London.
A vigil has been held in Gaza to condemn the spike in Israeli violations of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the West Bank. Over the past few days, and with the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, dozens of Israeli forces stormed the vicinity of the compound of Al-Aqsa Mosque. They assaulted and placated Muslim worshippers and forced them out of the holy site, paving the way for Israeli far-right extremists to enter the mosque. That prompted Palestinians and resistance factions to reiterate their readiness to defend Al-Aqsa and repeat the 2021 Operation Sword Al-Quds if the Al-Aqsa status quo is violated.
The Palestinian used to just look at the situation in the West Bank and Al-Aqsa Mosque. These violations crossed the red line and the Palestinian people began to lose their patience. The Palestinian resistance has something to say if the occupation regime crosses our red line.
Palestinians and Muslims reject the temporal and spatial division of the Al-Aqsa Mosque between Muslims and Jews. This is while Israel keeps violating the internationally agreed status quo of the mosque. Ramadan every year witnesses Israeli attacks against Palestinians gathered in the holy place. In 2021, the expulsion of Palestinian families from their homes in Al-Quds and the Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque during the holy month of Ramadan led to an 11-day aggression on Gaza. More than 260 Palestinians were killed during the assault, including 67 children and 41 women. Over 2,000 Palestinians were injured and many more internally displaced.
Our message to the Israeli occupation is that breaching the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque puts Israel on the verge of a collapse. Because our people will never remain silent over these violations, nor will they accept the temporal division of Al-Aqsa.
A surge in Israeli settler violence and military raids on Palestinian towns have claimed the lives of more than 90 Palestinians since the start of this year. That makes 2023 the deadliest year in decades in the occupied East Al-Quds and the West Bank.
We in Gaza are telling you that you can count on us. We support you in each and every step of operation you take against the Israeli occupation regime. We salute your struggle and reiterate our steadfastness toward our land. We will never leave our land.
There are concerns that tensions in the occupied territories would escalate. As Israeli forces and settlers continue their attacks on Palestinians and violate their sanctities in clear defiance of calls to stop the violence.
The repeated Israeli attacks against the Palestinians in the West Bank and the regime's flagrant violations of the Holy Al-Aqsa Mosque during the fasting month of Ramadan have been met with strong condemnations here in Gaza, where people express their unwavering support for Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Imam Khomeini's speech on the holy month of Ramadan. We hope that by the grace of the holy month, that is the feast of connection, we can also reap benefits so that we can overcome the problems befallen upon us. Not all the things brought by prophets aimed at the essence. Establishment of government is not for the prophets an essential purpose. All their invitation is prelude to awakening of human beings and making men understand what man has been, what he is and what he will be, and that how the world is and what relationship it has with the sacred essence of Allah Almighty.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear sisters and brothers from all over the world. You are listening to Spring of the Truth from IRB English Radio. In this program, we recite some of the sentences and speeches of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, who is the great marja and the political leader of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Since we are in the holy month of Ramadan, today we want to speak about this month in the viewpoint of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh. In that regard, he says, with the beginning of the month of Ramadan, it is necessary that nation uses its